I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
World Central Kitchen is serving thousands of fresh meals to Ukrainian families fleeing home, as well as people remaining in the country. This week on Let's Talk About Food, host Louisa Kasdan spoke with Henry Patterson about his upcoming relief trip.
So you're going to Poland, and I think you told me you're going to be there for at least 2 weeks.
I'm going to Poland to help feed Ukrainian refugees. With Jose Andreas's World Central Kitchen, I decided that's what I wanted to do for my 70th birthday. I leave in just a few days. We all see that what the Russians are doing is contemptible. As a food person, we all love to help. It's in our DNA. And here are people who really need our help. So if you want to help the Ukrainian refugees, either with money or even your hands and heart, find hashtag Chefs for Ukraine and World Central Kitchen. We have to do something. We can help. Remember hashtag Chefs for Ukraine.
This episode is brought to you by Bento Box, a full-service marketing and commerce platform that helps restaurants get discovered, make more money, and engage their diners. Join over 8,000 restaurants already using Bento Box today to deliver better hospitality. Visit getbento.com/HRN today to get your first month free. That's getbento.com/HRN.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm Mihosa Kikotayama, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from Brooklyn, New York. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deal in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi umami izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. My guest today is Sylvan Mishima Brackett, who is a chef and owner of Izakaya Rintaro in San Francisco's Mission District. Shortly after he opened the restaurant in 2014, Rintaro was included in Bon Appetit magazine's top 10 new restaurant list, and it has been beloved by many diners for the last 8 years. Born in Kyoto, Japan, and grew up in California, Sylvan has a unique and a beautifully balanced approach to Japanese food culture. He also worked for the iconic American chef Alice Waters for many years, who has deeply influenced his view to food. So today we'll discuss why the son of a Japanese temple carpenter decided to become a chef, Sylvan's apprenticeship at traditional Japanese restaurants in Japan, how he integrated Japanese and American food cultures at his restaurant, Rintaro, his favorite Japanese kitchen equipment, and much, much more. But before we start, Japanese is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, whichever you listen to, and subscribe to Japanese. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. And just one more thing. We are running a business membership drive right now. Heritage Radio Network, or HRN's business membership drive, that is. And we all know that small businesses keep our communities vibrant. For $500, HRN will shine a light on your work and help sustain a mission to expand the way people think about food. And this fundraiser will support not just my show, but the amazing HRN community of food podcasts. As a thank you for this tax-deductible donation, your business will receive on-air mentions, social media posts, listings on our website, and more. So if you're interested, please go to heritageradionetwork.org/biz, that's B-I-Z, to become a business member today. So that's heritageradionetwork.org/B-I-Z. Thank you so much. Now, let's start a conversation with Sylvan Mishima Brackett. Hello, Sylvan. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. Thank you so much for having me.
So this is exciting. I read about an article about you for many years ago, and I was always hoping to have you on the show. So my dream came today.
So, I'm so happy to be here.
So you have a very interesting background. And to get to know you first, where are you from, and what did you eat when you grew up?
So I was born in Kyoto, and when I was 8 months old, my parents, my mother's Japanese, my father's American, moved to the United States, and they bought land way out in the country, in Northern California, a very, very rural area. They actually had to clear the trees to make the place to build the house. There was no electricity or water or any utilities at all. And so I grew up very far out, probably 30 or 40 miles from the closest small town, in a place called Nevada City. I ate quite a bit of Japanese food, of course. My mother had a garden, so I spent, you know, a lot of time as a kid, you know, helping pick peas and pull carrots, and I had kind of a chance to see how food was grown.
Right. So that's the classic, the best part of Northern Californian climate and everything.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. And I'm really curious. So I heard that your father is a temple carpenter, which is very unusual. And I think inevitably you got influenced by him, because your restaurant is also helped built by him and you?
Yes. Right. So he studied as a temple carpenter's apprentice for 6 years, started when he was in his early 20s, and a pretty intense apprenticeship, you know, working, you know, we say 100 hours a week, and very little money and very little sleep and a lot of work, and pretty demanding. And you got to work on a lot of national treasure buildings, so like Kiyomizu-dera Temple and Sanju Sangendo and other kind of famous temples and shrines around Japan.
Oh, wow. Do you know how he got into that area?
I think that he was young and he was traveling through Japan. My my aunt was living there at the time, so he went to visit her. And he was interested in Buddhism, so he was sitting zazen, meditation, at a pretty well-known temple called Daitokuji. And his kind of teacher at the temple was a roshi named Kobori Roshi, who was a pretty influential guy. My father had no idea, and he kind of offhandedly mentioned that he was really interested in the architecture. And Kobori Roshi said that he would be willing to introduce him to one of the top temple carpentry companies in Japan. But if he did, he would have to commit at least 5 years to do the work. So he decided to do it.
Wow. That's amazing. Yeah. Right. So then how did you get into cooking? That's kind of like you could have pursued the same kind of path, but you chose cooking.
Yeah. My father was never very intense about having me take over his business. I mean, his father had worked for Pillsbury Mills in Minnesota, and I'd never particularly liked his job. He was the head of purchasing, so he used to buy literally millions of eggs at a time. But my father always talked to me about how my grandfather, he retired and then he died shortly afterwards, never really getting to do the thing he wanted to do. So my father was always pretty insistent that I follow the path of what is most interesting to me. And it was food. So I, as a little kid, loved to eat, and I still do. At a certain point, it kind of dawned on me that you could make a living through cooking. And so I started first by making pastries, because I was really interested in sweets and desserts. And then in high school, for my senior project, I opened a little restaurant at my high school, cooking whatever I could cook. Kind of a little pop-up, I guess is what you call them now, selling, you know, it was a very random collection. It was curry rice, Japanese curry rice, and pizza, and spaghetti with fresh noodles. I mean, it was all, you know, not very good, but it was my first experience cooking for money.
Right, and managing the pop-up.
Yes, exactly.
Right. So, but I think I would imagine if you didn't grow up in such a beautiful, you know, agriculturally advanced area, meaning like more artisanal, sustainable-minded area, probably you didn't get interested in cooking like that. Is that what you think?
I don't know. I mean, I think that it wasn't until I got to Chez Panisse that my eyes were really open to agriculture in that way. I mean, the garden my mother had was a small garden. We got most of our produce and vegetables and things came from the local supermarket. So I didn't think too much about organic stuff. I think my parents were buying organic produce when possible. And of course, my mother's garden was organic. But it wasn't until I got to Chez Panisse that I started to really, really pay attention to it and make the connection between flavor and the way things are grown.
Right. So let's talk about it. So you worked for 8 years as Alice Waters' assistant as well as Chez Panisse creative director. Mm-hmm. So for listeners who are not familiar with Alice Waters, she's an American chef, restaurateur, and author. And in 1971, she opened the iconic Chez Panisse in Berkeley, California, and it spearheaded the farm-to-table movement. So she is really a big deal, and she still keep going. So how did you get the job that allowed you to work so closely with that chef, famous Alice Waters?
I left Portland, where I went to college, and came to the Bay Area. I was living in San Francisco, and a family friend was working in her office and needed help with data entry or something. I think it was working on putting phone numbers into her famous black book, which has every phone number of every person you've ever heard of. It was around the time of the 30th anniversary of Chez Panisse, and it was going to be a huge event. And turns out they needed help. So I stuck. I hit it off with Alice, and she grew to trust me, and I was there for a long time.
Right. So what kind of job was that? You also did a, you know, creative job for the restaurant too.
Yeah. So for most of the time, I mean, my job kind of shifted. She had a couple of assistants at the time. So I was first the second assistant and then her primary assistant. But, you know, it wasn't in the kitchen. It was, you know, the less exciting stuff, scheduling and handling press inquiries. We also, at that time, she was working really closely with Slow Food. So there were these big events in Italy that I helped organize, you know, it was one amazing event. Farmers from all over the world to Turin for this big event called Terra Madre. So I helped, you know, coordinate all of the Chez Panisse network of farmers, or many of them at least, to get flights and help book hotels and get them all set up. She was working with the Prince of Wales on a project. She's working with Yale, the Sustainable Food Project there. So she just had her fingers in every pot and helped kind of coordinate all of these zillions of projects. It was, for me, amazing. I grew up in a really rural situation. And although I wasn't a total country boy, I'd spent quite a bit of time in Kyoto. And came to San Francisco quite often as a kid. I definitely didn't have the kind of access to the whole food world that I was suddenly plunked in the middle of. It was amazing.
Right, like really in the middle, like in the center of the world almost.
Yeah.
Right. Wow. So what did you learn from Alice Waters? I'm sure there are millions, but you have to narrow down to a few or just one. And how has it influenced you?
God, it's so hard to say. I mean, I was 24, 25, and I left when I was early 30s. So what could I say? I mean, they're the obvious things. Like, you know, if you're paying attention to where your food, how your food is grown and who's growing it, I mean, there's all sorts of amazing things. Of course, you, she always talked about how she started off looking for flavor and then ended up realizing that kind of organic and sustainable methods were the way to that. So it's not just kind of a virtuous thing about supporting these people who are, you know, making sure the soil health is good and kind of doing regenerative farming. It's also about the flavor. I think also there's a kind of similarity in the way that she thinks about food and kind of a traditional Japanese mentality, which is very much based on the flavor of the thing in itself and very clear, deep, strong flavors that aren't complicated, overly complicated. So I think that that definitely influenced me. And then there's all sorts of other, you know, ways of treating your employees. I mean, she had a restaurant where everybody had health insurance, still does. She instituted a service charge way before anybody else was, so that the front of house and the kitchen could be paid equitably. She thought about giving people vacation time and making restaurant work that could be sustainable, not just environmentally, but just not burning out your staff. She threw fabulous staff parties. And, you know, also, you know, realizing that in order to pay for all of this, you have to have a business that works and that makes money. And so not shying away from the fact that in order to support all of these people and support all these farmers, you have to have a business that takes care of the customers, that creates a feeling and an ambiance. And she's always been very clear about her vision of what she wants the restaurant to be. And the kind of feeling that she wants to kind of convey in the dining room.
Right.
It's always stuck to that.
Right. So it sounds like she spearheaded everything's happening now, like, you know, Blue Hillstone Barnes, Dan Barber's philosophy of chefs do not direct the cuisine, the nature does, and also Danny Meyer's the employee comes first to serve the best way for your customers. So she really did start everything. And an interesting point that you made, you know, the something common between Japanese and Alice Waters' philosophy of cooking, I think both direct or directed by nature, right? Seasonality. So we are kind of following the direction by nature, not the other way around.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that seeing, I mean, I think that kind of local seasonal has become such a common idea and that it can be feel a little dull now. But to put your kind of mind back to, you know, even the early 2000s when I started, you know, every small town did not have a farmer's market. Most restaurants were buying through vegetable distributors. When I first started at Chez Panisse, we'd occasionally go to the farmer's market, and there were not a lot of chefs there buying. If you go to the farmer's markets now in the Bay Area, you know, there's some are just basically chef's markets where it's almost all chefs purchasing. But it was a much different time, and it was quite revolutionary in a way.
Right. And she created a revolution for all the other regions in the U.S. So, yeah, it is, I really feel always grateful whenever I see farmers market in Union Square in New York, for example.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and then I heard about that you worked for Alice Waters and then you went back to Japan to train as a chef. So why did you decide to do so?
So I've been cooking Japanese food all through my time working at Chez Panisse and before. My mother and I cooked a lot, and she showed me lots of things, and I had lots of books and was very interested. But I was interested in the idea of opening an izakaya, which at the time there were maybe a couple in New York and maybe one in LA, but nothing in the Bay Area. And I think probably rubbing off from my father felt like this understanding that I really needed to train properly and spend some time in Japan. figure out how to do it right. So I did. I went to Japan.
Right. So when and how long did you work in Japan to train yourself?
I think it was 2007. I bought a one-way ticket to Tokyo, and I went to see my family, and my aunt and my uncle live in Japan, so my grandmother was alive at that time. And then I went and visited my friend Natsu Hachisu, who is now she's a fairly known Japanese, she's American, but she's written a number of really great Japanese cookbooks. And she was living with a farmer in a kind of a farming community in Saitama, north of Tokyo. And I had no idea what I was doing. I needed to find a place to work. So she connected me with a friend of hers, Kanji Nakatani, who has a restaurant called Soba Ro, and also a second one actually called Soba Ra. And at that time it was Ro. And he agreed that I could come and work with him a few days, I think it was 3 days a week. And I was there for 6 months or so. And then the other couple, few days a week, I went back to Tokyo, and I worked in another restaurant, Ryote, which is a much kind of fancier, kind of more elevated and kind of detailed sort of cooking at a place called Miyashita in Aoyama. So these are very, very different experiences. Aoyama being kind of like a fashion district in Tokyo, very urban, very sophisticated, and the restaurant Soba Ro is literally surrounded by rice paddies. So two totally different experiences. And it was exhausting because I didn't have any money, so I'd take the slow train, the Hachikosen. It was like a three-hour trip. And I would work in Aoyama a few days and then take the train out to Saitama and work there and have a day off once a week. So I did that for 6 months. But I was recently married, so I couldn't spend forever there. So I came back to America and started a catering company, Peko Peko, and we did, you know, parties and bento and all sorts of things. And then every year, once or twice a year, I'd go back and work with Kanji-san for a month or two. So I worked with them over the course of a long time.
So you, I would imagine you really acquired the basics of both kind of like a soba and more casual version restaurant experience, as well as the most formal, which is ryote style, like a kaiseki and a very super formal matai ghost dinner service. So other than actual culinary refinement you had, what is special about Japanese culture and Japanese food culture to you personally after spending time there as an adult?
It's kind of a big question, but I try to explain to people that you think of Japan as maybe the size of California with half the population of the United States for 2,000 years, and then you see what you get. And basically anything that Japanese culture has touched in the traditional crafts has been elevated, like simplified and elevated at the same time. So with temple carpentry, or carpentry generally, even just the tools, for instance, a hand plane used to plane wood is such a simple device. It's a block of wood with a blade that sticks out of it, but it's been refined to this unbelievable level. So you can plain piece of wood and get a shaving, which is like a hundredth the thickness of a piece of paper, and make the wood like glass smooth. And to get to that place, it takes so much kind of refinement and sophistication. And I think that there are so many things like that in Japanese culture, which, you know, encompass every realm, which I wanted to kind of show to my American friends through food.
Right. Yeah, I think there's a foundational difference in American mindset, right? Because everything new, powerful, and energy versus in Japan, it's such a small country and you have to preserve. We don't have much resources. So it's almost like a wabi-sabi mindset, which is admire old things and mm-hmm. you try to conserve, preserve everything. Because once we decide it, it's going to be valuable. So we spend all our life and attention to make it that way. So that's a very different mindset. So I think it's your father really captured that one even more than anybody else, that his kind of experience you can as an American person. Right. Okay. So we'll take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll discuss how the Sylvan beautifully merges Japanese and California food cultures at Rintaro. So please stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Bento Box, a restaurant marketing and commerce platform that helps you get discovered, make more money, and engage your diners so you can deliver great hospitality both in person and online. In the heart of Williamsburg, Brooklyn, Lilia combines wood-fired seafood, handcrafted pasta, classic Italian cocktails, and warm hospitality. Since 2016, it's been celebrated as a neighborhood gathering place, bringing the best of Italy to New York City. Lilia is one of over 8,000 restaurants that leverages Bento Box to power their digital front door, including their website, gift cards, event management, and more. Visit getbento.com/HRN today to learn more and get your first month free. That's getbento.com/HRN.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Aki Katayama, and my guest today is Sylvan Mishima Brackett, who is the chef and owner of Izakaya Rintaro in San Francisco's Mission District. Okay, so let's talk about your restaurant, Izakaya Rintaro, which you opened in 2014, and it remains very popular and cherished by many diners. So what is the concept of Izakaya Rintaro?
Let's see here. I think it's a way for me to bring a lot of parts of my kind of upbringing and my life all together. So, of course, I grew up in a traditional Japanese house that my dad built. So I wanted him to build the space for us. So it's, you can envision a fairly long, narrow space with kind of open beam structure and a lot of hand planed woods, and the mud wall is made out of the dirt from where I grew up in the country, a traditional plaster. I also wanted there to be really good music. I really, really wanted to not have a place that felt too serious. I wanted a place that felt like a party. So we have a great stereo system and really great playlists and try to keep the energy really high. Food-wise, of course, I think I've said in the past, think of California as though it were a region of Japan. It's kind of a crazy idea, but to think about the things we could get in California that were really special and really try to highlight those ingredients. So for the most part, the meats and the fishes and the vegetables all are from the West Coast. We get all of our dried goods, our shoyu, soy sauce, and katsuobushi, and all of the preserved foods from Japan. But for the fresh foods, we use some other stuff.
Right. So, okay, so it sounds like the essence of Japanese culture and Californian flavors are always there. And that's kind of your clone in the kitchen. And you're known for being in the kitchen without leaving. You're actually with you.
Yeah, I'm here. I'm here a lot.
Right. So, by the way, why did you name your restaurant Rintaro?
Rintaro means, the translation is boy of the woods. And it's actually a direct translation of my name, Sylvan. It wasn't ever really a nickname that I had in Japan, but I like the kind of reference to where I grew up. And it was a nickname that was given to me by the head priest at that temple, Daikokuji, so Komori Roshi. spoke English, and so when he heard my name, he knew that the translation was Rintaro. I also kind of like the all the Taro names have a kind of old-fashioned feel to them, which I like. So that's why I named Rintaro.
I really found it very cool. And I didn't know that Daidakuji's head name, the name. That's the coolest, most important name. Okay. So based on your unique background and experience, so what is your philosophy of cooking? And in other words, what is always in your mind when you cook or think of cooking?
I think it's really important to me to have really clear flavors. Right now, for instance, we're making a clear soup. On Mondays, we do a kind of a special, more formal course meal. And one of the courses is a suimono, so it's clear broth, katsuobushi broth. So we get really nice katsuobushi direct from the maker in Kagoshima. I visited him a few times. He ships directly to us. And we have a shaver, and we shave it. We make really fragrant, deep flavored dashi. And then it will be with lingcod fish cake, and then some sweet peas. And the sweet peas, the sugar stamp peas, have just come in to season here. So to blanch them perfectly, and we're going to take the peas out and slice the husks very into little thin slivers. So when you eat it, it should be a really right taste of the pea and the kind of depth of the dashi and the clear, kind of salty fish of the shinjo, the fish cake.
Mm.
So for me, it's and it's only, what is that, three ingredients. So I want everything on the plate or in the bowl to be very deep and flavorful and have a lot of guts, if that makes any sense.
Mm, right. So other people say the Japanese cuisine is the cuisine of reduction versus French is addition. The kind of classic saying probably applies to undoubtedly to your kitchen. So, and then how do you call your food? What do you call your Rintaro's cooking as like traditional or slightly creative or... What's the range of it?
It's fairly traditional, I'd say. I mean, I think when I first started, I felt very, not hemmed in, but felt like a lot of heavy weight to do things always extremely traditionally. And I think I've loosened up over the years as I've gotten better. And to kind of trust my own taste and allow myself to think creatively about, you know, putting together flavors that might not be hyper-traditional.
I was looking at one of the items on your menu. It's the Kamatama Udon. So Rintaro, 100-volt udon and carbonara with a raw egg, yolk, butter, ginger, scallion, and freshly shaved katsuobushi. It's like, you can't go wrong with this. I really wish I could just have it right now. So, yeah, it's kind of a Japanese... yoshoku style of how you merge Western flavors like butter naturally into Japanese traditional context.
Right. I think that's a good example. I mean, it's something that we used to make at the end of the night for the staff with the leftover udon. And we make udon here every day. So it's udon that we make is very chewy. So it's like sudasuda koshikaru. Slippery on the outside and kind of soft on the outside and very chewy on the inside. The idea was first I had Kamatama udon, and that's traditionally made by taking udon noodles out of the hot water right after they're boiled. Rather than washing them, which firms them up, you put it into a bowl and crack an egg over it and add some soy sauce and maybe ginger. But I was thinking about how to refine it a little bit and how to keep that great texture. So we pull the udon out and then wash it, which really firms it up, and then heat it up again in the boiling water, drain it, and then add the butter, which kind of adds a lot of delicious richness, and then udon kaishi. Udon kaishi is a seasoning base made with soy sauce and mirin and katsuobushi, and then more shaped katsuobushi, and then the egg yolk rather than the whole egg. So it's a little bit more concentrated and rich.
Right. So it sounds ostensibly simple, but there's so much going on in the bowl.
Right. Yeah. It's just if you don't have good udon, it kind of doesn't work very well.
Right. Okay. And also you have yoshi tofu. You have house-made silken tofu. Obviously, you make tofu, mm-hmm. which is amazing. I mean, not just udon takes a long time. You have to make a good udon. You have to really know what to do. So it's very impressive. And and also I noticed that you use for example, kabocha croquette. You have potato croquettes with fresh Acme panko. So mm-hmm. Acme is San Francisco's proud bakery, right?
Yes.
So it's kind of very local, but very traditional Japanese too. So I really thought it was awesome.
Yeah. So that bread, I spent a while trying to find the right kind of bread, kind of like the milk bread in Japan, which is used to make great fresh panko. And they have a loaf called the pan de mie, which is just that. It's milk and eggs and a little butter in it. It's very soft and makes wonderful panko. Makes all of the panko things especially special, crunchy.
Right. Okay, yeah, if you go to the supermarket, they sell panko, but it's not anything like real good panko. So, yeah, I'm sure it's amazing. And, yeah, Acme, it's interesting, right? As people think of very Western kind of bakery, but they really are flexible to make that kind of good quality. Do you make panko by yourself or you ask them to do it?
No, we buy the loaves from them and then we trim the crusts and make panko. We've actually, one thing that's been bothering me for years is that we throw away these just huge bags of crusts, tried many things, use them up, but haven't really come up with anything good. So it makes beautiful compost.
Okay. And you have a deep understanding of Japanese food and great ingredients of California. So how do you merge Japanese food culture, your upbringing in America, and amazing ingredients in California? I mean, it could be how you come up with the recipes or how you run restaurants or any comments on that?
For merging Japanese food culture, I think the biggest thing for me is to really try to instill in the cooks that there's depth in almost everything. Person who makes the tofu, for them to really understand that there's a lot of subtlety in making the tofu. It's not just you follow a recipe, do once, and you've got it. Or even when you're frying, the tonkatsu or chicken katsu, it's to fry it really, really well takes a lot of focus and attention. So there are a few things, cutting scallions, for instance. I don't think that I realized how specific it was until I started training people on how to do it and how your knife has to be a razor sharp and how each scallion needs to be cut razor thin and then you've got to wash them very well and dry them very well and you end up with something which is great. And kind of trying to instill that idea that you don't, it takes a long time to get good at something. Mm. And I think that with younger cooks, there's a sense that, you make something once and you're a master of it. But, for instance, I've been making rolling udon since 2007, and I am still learning how to make it better.
Right. That's what all masters say, right? You are forever students. So
it's not easy, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Right. I'm curious that, if you don't dry the scallions well and then your knife is not sharp enough, you're going to waste the kind of a juice in the vegetable? Or is that...
Yeah, what happens, you end up crushing them and they, after you wash them, they're just kind of like mushy. If you've got a very sharp knife, it'll cut right through it at kind of a silo level and you won't have, it won't crush them. And then when you wash them, they'll be really like light stick together in a little pile in a way.
Right. All right. So, I'll sharpen my knife today for my scallions tonight. I heard that you love using traditional Japanese cooking equipment and utensils. So what are some of your favorites?
I'm working on a cookbook, actually, and starting to test recipes for that and realizing, for instance, grating daikon, you really need to have a daikon grater. A box grater doesn't really work very well, so it's kind of a square-shaped thing with teeth that stick out of it, a rough side for daikon and the fine side for ginger. We get fresh wasabi from an amazing farm called Half Moon Bay Wasabi down south of San Francisco, and they deliver once a week. And we use a shark skin grater. So it's shark skin laminated to a piece of wood, and it grates it really, really fine. And you get this wonderful, smooth, kind of almost creamy paste. You know, dashimaki tamago, famous folded omelet. It really can't be accomplished without a good square copper pan.
Can I ask you questions? So the grater, the metal grater, what is the difference? Because I have one and I can tell it's juicier and it's finer, right? It's just the whole scrapey, like grainy fiber gets stuck in the metal.
Right.
And what you get is just a really juicy, flavorful chunk of what you're looking for, like a daikon or a ginger. Right. And so the other one, I think shark skin, I think it's like if you go sit at the sushi counter, a sushi chef will show you how this shark skin can work, and it's just magical. There's nothing else other than the shark skin. But and also if you go to, Tsukiji Market, the market, that's the move to Toyosu, but they still have a market, and they sell that, the egg. Omelette pan, the tiny little pan, which is cute.
Yeah.
And I've never owned it. Does it work differently? What's the difference to make a good omelette?
For ours, we've been using ours for years. We have two of them. And I've replaced the handles. We've burned the handles, three or four handles out. And the ones we have are made of copper, so they distribute the heat very evenly. We've also been using them for such a long time. They're, as nonstick as Teflon. Which is, of course, very important when you're doing dashimaki, tamago. And, of course, the shape, it's square. So if you want a rectangular omelet, it helps to have a rectangular pan.
Okay. So maybe that's the one I have to purchase next time I go to Japan.
Oh, for sure,
this kind of, it's really so cool. So why do you think Izakaya Rintaro has been so popular since its opening in 2014?
Oh, God, who knows? I mean, seriously, restaurants are such a mystery. I mean, we had, I had built up a nice customer base through the catering. I had done a lot of pop-ups, and we've gotten a little bit of press. We have had an amazing team, both the servers and the kitchen. I think we try to keep it light. There's a lot, I'm talking a lot about kind of the philosophy of what I'm doing, but I ideally don't want to beat people over the head with that when they come in. I want them to have a place where they can relax and have a couple of beers and some sake and eat something delicious. So it's been about making a place where, a space where people want to be. As much as
Right, and I saw a picture. It's the decor, of course. It's kind of like a Kyoto Machiya kind of feeling. It's very authentic but casual, open, and just looks very comfortable. So I have, full disclosure, I have never been there. So next time I can travel to San Francisco,
absolutely,
I'll definitely be there. So, and so you also have, you mentioned you have a catering company called the Peko Peko, which means hungry in a very cute way. So you started the company before you opened Izakaya Rintaro. So, and it's still going, right? So who do you serve and what kind of food do you offer?
Well, actually, Peko Peko was folded into the restaurant, so Peko Peko no longer exists except for my head. But we started in 2008, and if you remember, the American economy had a collapse around that time. So my original idea had been to do a lot of caterings and parties. It didn't work out so well because everyone was afraid of spending money. So I pretty quickly started to do pop-ups. So I had friends with new restaurants in San Francisco and Berkeley, and I would do events in their space. Kind of. At this point, I started making good playlists and started to try out recipes. And Peko Peko was really a time for me to build the staff, try to adapt a lot of the foods that I love in Japan to America. So that means finding the ingredients. So I spent a lot of time looking for bamboo shoots and sancho leaves and ume, Japanese plums, and yuzu, and kind of coming up with our sources. Luckily, in California, there was a huge migration from Japan at the turn of the century. So there are a lot of Japanese Americans and a lot of Japanese American farmers who've provided a lot of fabulous stuff for us.
Right. Okay. So I'm sure you, it's the name is not Peko Peko, but do you offer catering services if you get a request?
Not, we used to, but since the pandemic, I've just been focusing on the restaurant. So we haven't been able to do much catering recently. Trying to build everything back since the pandemic.
Right. Okay, we'll see what happens because New York City is everything's really changing quickly, and as if nothing happened, people started to dine out and do whatever they want to do. Right. So, okay, and since you started Peko Peko in 2008 and opened Izakaya Rintaro in 2014, have you seen any changes in Japanese food culture in the Bay Area?
Yeah, it's been pretty amazing, actually. When I first started, very few people that I knew had been to Japan. Non-Japanese people, of course. And since then, Tokyo and Kyoto have become this like huge destination for American tourists. So the kind of sophistication of the diners has really increased in a kind of an amazing way. And you can kind of even see that with the knives that chefs use. A lot of cooks go to Japan. And I would say, whereas when I started, most people were using German knives, now the bulk of the better chefs are using Japanese knives. So there's just a lot more sophistication around Japanese food. And in the Bay Area, since I've opened, there have been quite a large number of very, very high-end sushi places have opened. Omakase kind of menus, $200, $300, $400 per person sort of places, most of which are bringing fish directly in from a place called Tsukiji, now it's Toyosu Market. So sadly, not much using local stuff, but definitely highly trained, pretty sophisticated sushi.
Right. Well, it's good to have the whole ranges, right? From, pretty good supermarket sushi, I can see. And also really like $450 per person kind of place. You have a choice. And I think you really hit the middle perfect point of, the need for izakaya. And I feel like when looking at your place and pictures and the menu, I wish just like you said tonight, Monday night is a little fancier menu. And, we want to treat myself, maybe I just stop by tonight. The kind of like really inviting, nice place. So, congratulations. So what are your plans and dreams?
Let's see here. I guess when I first started Rintaro, I was started thinking about it in my 20s, and I really enjoyed going out and drinking too much and eating too much and listening to loud music. And I'm older and I'm now kind of more interested in maybe a slightly quieter experience. So tonight, for instance, it's called Kapo Rintaro. So I wouldn't say it's kaiseki, but it's a lot more refined, controlled course menu. And this kind of cooking for me is very exciting at the moment. So, for instance, I have a little sancho tree here. Sancho is it's related to Szechuan peppercorns. It's kind of a numbing spice. And in the spring, it shoots out these little green leaves called kiname, which you can use, which are now getting a little bit too big for us, but it has fresh berries. So I just 20 minutes ago harvested all of our sancho berries and boiled them, and I'm going to serve them with some of the local black cod, which has been cured with miso. I'll grill that over the charcoal. And because it's much fewer people, we can do much more refined cooking with ingredients that we have less of. So a very small amount of perfect snap peas and a very small amount of sancho. And we have enough to serve just a number of people coming tonight.
So tell us a little bit more about the Kapo Rintaro so we can discover more.
So it's, I think it's six courses. It always starts with a zensai, which is kind of a seasonal plate with, you know, between 3 to 5 different items. So, for instance, today we'll be making goma tofu. So it's sesame tofu. So it's actually not tofu at all. It's sesame, really good sesame from a producer called Wadaman. And really nice dashi. And it's thickened with kudzu, which is arrowroot starch. And it sets, and it's got a really marvelous, rich texture. And we'll serve that with a little wasabi. And then we're making a nikogori, which is an aspic with bones from striped bass and a little bit of striped bass and halibut meat in there, and ginger and red pepper. And then kind of special today, and on Kapo nights, I will buy stuff from Japan in a way I don't usually. So we're going to get the firefly squid, which are now kind of peak season in Japan. So we'll serve that with some komatsuna, which is kind of related to American spinach, maybe. Kind of more like bok choy, maybe. From a farmer, Hikari Farm, which we buy it from weekly, they sent us a big bunch of the flowers, shooted. So we're going to boil those and serve it with a hotarika and nuta, which is a sauce made with white miso, egg yolk, and spicy karashi, Japanese hot mustard.
Right. So this concept is a weekly kind of, you just switched the name as Kapo Rintaro on Mondays.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And are you planning to make it permanent and at a different location, or?
I'd like to at some point. I don't know. I mean, only one restaurant's enough. So, a lot. Another thing I learned from my old boss was it takes a lot to make one restaurant good, and, you know, more than twice as much to make two good. So we'll see what happens.
Right. Well, sounds like a very solid good lesson. Okay. So where can we find your updates online and on social media?
Probably mostly through Instagram. So I'm Mr_Rintaro.
Okay.
Post photos there, not as often as I probably should. But I have exciting things and I have time, I'll take a picture and put it up.
Okay. We'll definitely follow that. So, well, thank you so much for joining us today, Sylvan. And I look forward to tasting your dishes at your restaurant, it's either Kapo Rintaro or actual Yuzakaya Rintaro.
Great, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanese@theheritageradionetwork.org or kikotema.com. Japanese is a weekly program and always available at heritageradionetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer is Amin Spencer, and thank you for listening. I will see you next week. Japanese is powered by Simplecast.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.
Hi, I'm Katie Mosman-Wadler, Executive Director of HRN. HRN is dedicated to amplifying small businesses that keep our communities vibrant. Today, I'm asking business owners to take part in our business membership drive by supporting HRN's mission with a $500 membership. HRN will shine a light on your work, and you'll help sustain our mission to expand the way eaters think about food. As a thank you for this tax-deductible donation, your business will receive on-air mentions, social media posts, listings on our website, and more. You'll also play an essential role in keeping nonprofit food radio on the air. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/biz to become a business member today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/biz. Thank you for your support.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.